Go ahead and turn to Romans with me. We started Romans a couple of weeks ago, and last week, Paul actually shared with us his desire to go and visit the Romans. Remember, he had not met them personally. So this, as we assume here, this writing was his first introduction or introducing himself to the believers in Rome. And he finished last week's section up by asserting his confidence in the gospel that it was the power of God unto salvation. And he says that it was revealed from faith to faith. And as we discuss that, what that basically means is that our relationship with Christ starts with faith and continues in faith, which means we come to Christ in faith, and then we live in faith as well. And so this phrase at the very end of the section from last week, that the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, simply means that. And as we talked about that, that phrase righteousness of God referred primarily to God's righteous acts. In other words, that it's through the gospel that we see God's righteous act in saving people who do not deserve to be saved. Well, this week, we're going to actually get into a rather difficult portion of the book. We're going to talk about God's wrath and His judgment. And we're going to see that as we go through this book, Paul has a system in mind. He's teaching the Roman readers about judgment and wrath and justification and other things. And so he starts with a discussion on condemnation and God's wrath. From there, he moves on to justification. How is it that God deals with that wrath? And then lastly, he gets into a discussion on sanctification, which is ultimately holy living or living that out. Once we get through that, we're going to take a slight break. We're going to look at some other things, and then we'll come back to the book of Romans and look at chapters 9, 10, and 11, which are all about Israel's place in God's plan. If you understand your history, God worked primarily with the Israelites until we got to this time period that we refer to as the period of the Gentiles, which was basically initiated with Christ and the church. And the question is, what happens to Israel? And Paul discusses that in God's plan for sanctification and other things in chapters 9, 10, and 11. So we'll come back and do those. And then we'll probably take another break from the book because it's such a long book, and then spend some time dealing with what's called the practical application portion of the book, which comes in about chapter 12 and following. So today we're in chapter 1, and Paul begins this small series, if you will, on judgment or wrath. And we're going to see this broken down into three primary sections today. The first one is that God's wrath is real and a result of our sin. We live in a world today that has no concept about the wrath of God. In fact, even among the church, many have this idea that God was a God of wrath in the Old Testament, but today He's just a God of love and gentleness and kindness and just a lovey-dovey kind of God. And we're going to see that Paul has a different perspective on that. Look at just the first few verses here. We'll just look at actually starting with verse 18. Paul says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them." So he starts off with a fairly frank statement. He says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven." Basically, what Paul tells us here is that most of the world's population lives in willful ignorance or disobedience to this. In fact, many Christians, like I said, have a faulty understanding of God and His justice and His wrath and His righteousness. And they only see that God is a God of grace, mercy, and love. But Paul speaks about God's wrath here in the present tense. Did you notice what he says? He doesn't say, "For God's wrath was revealed." He says, "God's wrath is revealed." That's a present tense. It means it's something that is ongoing, it's continual. And if we remember, Greek tenses aren't so much past, present, and future as they are a one-time act or ongoing. And so when you see something in the present tense like this, it applies to today in that sense, but it means that it is ongoing more than anything. Because Greek tenses are all about the type of action, which means that a present verb can be used in the past tense. Can be used in the prayer. It gets a little bit confusing, but the primary emphasis here is that it means it's ongoing. And so this isn't about God having wrath at one point. It's that God's wrath is ongoing. It's continual. And God's wrath will continue ultimately until we get into Revelation chapter 20 and 21 where we see he finally recreates the heavens and the earth. And at that point, there's no more need for God's wrath. So Paul tells us here that God's wrath is ongoing, which means he currently pours out his wrath. Again, it's not just what he did in times past. It's not just what he did in the Old Testament and now he's changed his mind or changed his character. So what is this wrath that Paul talks about here? The word that's used here by Paul simply means anger or fury. It isn't just being a little bit irritated. It isn't just being a little bit angry or upset. It actually means to be furious at something. I'd ask for a show of hands here if anybody here has ever experienced that themselves. You ever get furious? You know what I'm talking about. There's times where, yeah, you get a little bit mad, a little bit irritated, but then there's those times where it's maybe the gritting of the teeth or you're just really ticked off. Well, that's the idea here is that this is not just anger, but fury. In fact, if you define this, you look at what Webster says about wrath, it defines it this way, retributory punishment for an offense or a crime. And that's one of the things about wrath. There's a reason behind it. There's something that drives it. It isn't just that God flies off the handle. Look at what it says here. It says that this wrath of God's is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. So there's a reason for it. Again, God doesn't just fly off the handle. It says that his wrath is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. We're going to look at that in a little bit. But you notice here that he says it's revealed. This word revealed actually means to make something fully known. It means to bring it to the surface. To show it. And so basically what happens is because of the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, God's wrath becomes known. It becomes shown. It's brought to the forefront. It's something that's revealed. It's not simply a state. It's not just an emotion. It's rather an act. It involves judgment of sin. I want you to look at Romans chapter 2, verse 5 here. It says, but because of the stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation at the righteous judgment of God. And so God's wrath involves judgment. It's an act. It's not just God gets angry, yells and screams and flails his arms, and then he's done with it until he cools down. The wrath of God that Paul is talking about here is an act of God carrying out judgment on men because of their unrighteousness and their ungodliness. So what is this ungodliness and unrighteousness that Paul talks about here? Ungodliness simply means just that. It means to be unlike God. Remember, you know, the thing that's striking about this is when God created Adam and Eve, what was the thing that was unique about Adam? Among all of God's other creatures, what was the thing that set Adam apart from everything else? He was created in God's image. He was made to be like God. And it is an offense, therefore, to not be like God. That's the way he created Adam and Eve. They were to express the image of God, display his attributes, his character. As he is holy, they were to be holy. As he was to be righteous, they were to be righteous. As he was to be just, they were to be just. And so what happens here is God, as he looks at mankind, because mankind has become all the opposite of those things. He has become ungodly. He has chosen to live in a way that shows that he is not like the one that actually created him. And that's an offense to him. It goes against the way that he was created. What about unrighteousness? It's similar, but instead unrighteousness reflects a disregard for what is right. A disregard for what is right. And not only that, but it generally means that it favors wrong. Sometimes it's translated as injustice, but unrighteousness is the idea of pushing back against what's right. Loving what's wrong instead. And so we see here that God's wrath is poured out because we have chosen to be unlike him, and we have chosen to reject right, and instead to favor wrong. Paul's going to mention that a little bit later, very end of verse 32, where he basically talks about people applauding things that are not right. The last thing I want to point out from this first part of this verse here is that it applies to all of mankind. Notice that the text does not say that God's wrath is revealed against all the unrighteousness and ungodliness or ungodly men. Notice it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that God reveals his wrath against ungodly men and unrighteous men. What does it say? It says he reveals his wrath against all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men. There's a difference in that phrase, folks. Because what it indicates is that men, which is just a term for mankind, are unrighteous and ungodly. All of them are that way. It is their unrighteousness and ungodliness that they simply ooze, if you will, that God pours out his wrath. He doesn't say here that God is simply upset with those who are ungodly. We're all ungodly. In fact, turn to Romans chapter 3 with me. We're going to get to this chapter a little bit in the next couple of weeks here, but I want you to see this. It's not only some people that face the wrath of God. It's not just the bad people. It's all people. Look at Romans chapter 3, starting in verse 10. Paul says, as it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths, and the paths of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Paul starts off by saying, there's none righteous, not even one, in and of themselves. And so what we find in this very first verse alone is that God's wrath is real, and it's because of our sin, because none are righteous. Now, that's not the way the world wants to see it, because the world likes to categorize people into good, bad, and ugly. You know, you have Hitler. He was bad, you know. Mao Zedong was bad, you know. Stalin was bad. But, you know, then there's those not-so-bad people, which, obviously, it's always us, right? Because we're not as bad as Hitler. It's all just a scale, right? Long as our good deeds outweigh the bad deeds, we're not so bad, and God wouldn't pour out us. But what does Paul say? The scriptures make it abundantly clear that left to our own devices and will, we bend towards wickedness. We bend towards evil. And I think if we just, I'd say look at our own children and think about the struggles we have with raising them. What is their bent normally? You know, we're to discipline. But rather than do that, I'll have us think about ourselves as we grew up. You all know what we're like. You know, I think probably everyone else in this room is saved. And yet, even being saved, what's the struggle we often have? I think if we're all to be honest here, we still do bad things. You know, good people doing bad things, right? And if we struggle as Christians, imagine what happens to the unsaved world that doesn't have the indwelling work of the Holy Spirit. Now, that doesn't mean that people out there can't do good things. That's pretty clear. But that doesn't mean they don't do bad things. Paul tells us again that there's not one that's righteous. And again, you have to remember that the standard is God, because it says that the wrath is poured out because of ungodliness. We're not like God, like we should be. We're broken because of sin. And because of that, we're going to find out that God's wrath is justified. Look at point number two here. God's wrath is justified because of this. Look at verses 18, the very end of verse 18, and then I think we'll go through about 23. He says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, and of birds, and four-footed animals, and crawling creatures. What Paul tells us in this particular section here is that God's wrath is justified. Notice it says that the natural tendency for us is to suppress the truth in unrighteousness. To suppress something means to cover it up, to hold it back, to put a cover over it. And that's what happens when God's truth is revealed. Think about this. God came in flesh and walked on this earth. And what was the world's response to that? They didn't like him. They put him to death. Drove spikes through his hands and feet. There's about a week period in there where they all rejoiced. But ultimately, they suppressed the truth and unrighteousness and put him on a cross. That's the natural tendency when it comes to looking at God's truth. Look at what we face here in the United States now. I don't know how many of you saw this just recently, but anybody know what today is? Sanctity of Life Sunday. 8 days before your birthday. Sanctity of Life Sunday, that's when we sort of bring recognition to the abortion holocaust that's been going on in the nation for years. But did you see what happened just the other day with the abortion clinic? I think it was it D.C. that opened up? It was a brand new abortion clinic here in the United States. And all these clergy members showed up and blessed the place. There were Baptists there. There were Methodists there. There were Unitarian Universalists there. There were Buddhists there. There was a rabbi there. All, in fact, it was interesting. I don't know if it was it might have been the rabbi's prayer about blessing this place because the work they do is sacred. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That's what we do. It says we do that in unrighteousness, or another way to translate that is by means of unrighteousness. It's by our activity. By the things that we do, we take this truth of God and we push it down and we cover it up. Isn't that exactly what happened in the garden? The truth was, don't touch from the tree. When you do, you'll die. But by reaching out and eating that, that takes that truth and shoves it down, covers it up. You notice it's interesting because Paul talks about this truth here. What is it that gets suppressed? You know, you often have heard, what about those people way in the middle of the jungles? You know, they haven't heard the name of Jesus. How can God be judgmental with them? How can he condemn them? Well, Paul tells us why here. Look at verse 19. He says, because that which is known about them, that which is known about them, or not about God, is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. So Paul says that it's evident within. Notice it doesn't say evident to them, but within them. There is something internal that God built into the human that he would recognize that there is a divine creator who created him. That there are divine rules and laws, which is why no matter where you go on this planet, you will find religious systems. Why is that? Isn't that a weird quirk? Everywhere you go, people have a religious system of some kind. Now, there's atheists. They try to reject that, obviously. But they're pushing back against something, aren't they? They're atheists. They're pushing back against the idea of a God. Why? Because the rest of the world believes there's a God of some kind. Now, there's all kinds of varying ideas, obviously, which is what Paul is getting at here. But the reality of it is God has placed within us evidence. He also has placed that into his creation. And so because of that, Paul says that they are without excuse. But he also tells us exactly what this is. Look at what he does in verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen. He tells us three things there that are revealed about himself everywhere. Even to those folks who don't have a copy of the New Testament or the Old Testament, there is something in God's creation that he reveals clearly with enough evidence, internally and externally. And it's these three things. The one of them is his eternal power. You know, it's interesting because most world religions recognize that the divine being has power above and beyond them. That this thing is all powerful. It's clear in God's creation. The second thing it reveals is his divine nature. That it's different. It isn't just a human that created everything, but rather, as they look at this creation, they can see that this being is divine. There's something beyond the earthly, if you will. And the last thing, he says, invisible attributes. Invisible attributes. It's interesting. They know certain things about this God. It's interesting how so many of these pagan religions recognize that there's a penalty for sin. They make sacrifices to try to appease their gods, right? That's a divine thing, that there is retribution for when you do wrong, when you offend God. They recognize that. Now, they got it wrong in terms of how it works, but they can see clearly that there's divine attributes, that this God isn't just a force in some respects, but has attributes. So Paul says that these things are all revealed in God's creation. Turn with me to Psalm chapter 19. Psalm chapter 19 is a great psalm because it tells us the two ways that God actually speaks to us. If you look at the psalm, the first six verses, David is speaking about how God addresses his creation through creation, what we can see in what's called general revelation. In verses 7 through the rest of the psalm, what David does is tells us that God also speaks. And so certain things are revealed in his creation, and there are certain things that are revealed through his word. And this psalm walks us through that. But let's just look at the first six verses. We'll just read them. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. That means that you can look out and you can see God's glory and you can realize this was created and done by him. Day unto day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge, which means God's creation reveals knowledge, not just about itself, but about God. Now it says there's no speech nor are there words, their voice is not heard. It simply means that it does that without having to have God say, well, look, I did this. Okay? So it says their speech has gone out, meaning they can clearly talk and reveal, but it's done without words. Something God has built into his creation. It says their line has gone out through all of the earth, their utterance to the end of the world, which means there's not a place you can go on this planet. And in fact, I would argue there's not a place you can go on without anywhere in the universe without seeing the glory of God and these things that the author talks about. It says, in them he has placed a tent for the sun, which is a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run its course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens and its circuit to the other end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. Basically meaning that everywhere you go, God reveals himself through his creation. There's not a place on this planet, there's not a place in this universe you can go that God's voice cannot be heard or screamed from this creation. And again, now does it reveal everything? No, it's not the author's point, or David's point, it's not Paul's point here. The point of this passage is that there is enough, that God has revealed enough in his creation to hold men and women accountable. And with that little bit of knowledge that they've received about him, they take that and they suppress that. Now it's no wonder why they treated Jesus the way they did. It's no wonder why they killed the prophets the way they did. If they don't like what they see here, and if they suppress what they see here, the things about God's invisible attributes, his divine power, his divine nature, if they take and suppress those things, then it's no shock that when he actually speaks and reveals his truth, that they take that and they push that down as well. So Paul's point in these few verses here is that God's wrath is justified. He has chosen to reveal himself to his creation. In fact, it all started with God walking in the garden. Remember that? When he created Adam? God actually walked in the garden, it says. Revealed himself. And even with that, Adam and Eve chose to suppress the very simple truths that God had given them. Don't eat from the tree. Stay away from the tree. If you do, you die. And they chose to suppress that in unrighteousness, in sin. So not only is God's wrath real and a result of our sin, it's justified. Regardless of what the world tries to tell us, it's justified. We got what was coming to us. And I remember when I was growing up, they'd done some road construction out in front of our house. And the crew had left a giant hole it was a square hole, right out in front of our house. And they had the barricades up. It's a warning, a little tape and stuff. And they had the little pylons. And it was middle of winter time. Probably, I'm guessing, low 30s, because the water wasn't frozen. But it was cold. And I had gone out to play with some of my friends. And I had all the typical winter garb, which was these rubberized snow pants. that tucked into rubber boots. I don't know if you remember years ago. Some of you, you're not as old as me, but you used to have these. Christmas story. Yeah, it was. It looked like the Christmas story. These puffy pants, and they were stuffed into my boots, and then the boots were rubber. And they had these steel clips. Do you remember those boots, the steel clips that you would clamp over? And that was airtight, practically. You know, they would just snap those in, and then you had the winter jacket that was tucked in, and the pants were tied up tight, and I had gloves on, you know, with the straps, and I was completely bundled up. And so I remember going out with my friends and seeing this giant hole and all this tape around it. And Mom and Dad had even said, don't go play by the hole, right? Well, what do you suppose we did? Sure enough, I go over there, we go underneath the tape, you know, and I remember sitting on the edge of that with my friend right across from me, and we were trying to see if we could touch our boots into the water because there was water filled up in the bottom of this hole. And so we're dipping it, you know, and he'd get so far, and I'd go, well, I can get a little further, and I'd do a little bit further, you know, and then he'd say, well, I can get further, and he'd do a little bit further, and we weren't quite getting to the water yet. But man, I sure found the water because at one point, then all of a sudden, when I went too far, I went in, boom, and I still remember floating. Literally just floating in the water, trying to figure out how in the world I was going to get out. You know, and to this day, I don't remember how I got out. But I literally remember just floating there saying, okay, go get mom, you know, because it was down pretty deep, you know. And I remember, the next picture I have in my mind is that I was in the basement taking off my clothes and dumping water out of my boots over the drain that we have in the basement. And hearing Mom say, well, I told you not, you know. But my point in bringing up this story is just this. You know, my mom had warned me about the hole, but she didn't even need to do that. I knew, I'm looking at this thing, it's got the warning tape around it and the pylons out there, but even if you wouldn't have done that, I'm sitting on the edge of this thing and I knew it was dangerous. I mean, but yet it didn't stop me. You know, I'm still reaching down, I'm going to touch it, you know, I'm still walking that fine line, you know. That is just our nature, isn't it? To push the envelope. We see wrong and we do it anyway. You know, we play around, we dance around the edges until we end up falling in. And then when we fall in, whose fault is it? Somebody else's fault. The guys that, you know, today they would sue the road crew, wouldn't they? It's your fault for digging a hole, you know. And so now they cover it up with a big steel plate and they put the tar around it, you know. And it's because it's their fault, not my fault, for not listening to my mom, going out and walking past the tape and the pylons, and tucking away every shred of common sense that I have, but it's somehow their fault. No, that's not the way it works. And so that's kind of the picture you get here, is that God built into his creation all this stuff for mankind to see and to know. And what they do is they just push that down. They cover it up. And so when God's wrath is revealed, whose fault is it? It's ours. And again, that pushes back against what the world thinks. Because the world, especially today, nobody wants to take responsibility for anything. How could a loving God do this? Because you broke his laws. Well, what right does he have to make those laws? Because he's God? You're not? I don't know. Sounds good to me. But you see, I'm saved. You know? It's not my own thinking. My own thinking would say he doesn't have that right. Doesn't have that right. If you offend him, so what? He should just move on. It's his fault if he's offended, not mine. But that's not what Paul says here. He says that God's wrath is justified. Whether the world likes it or not, or whether the world agrees with us or not, God is justified. Now, what's interesting is it doesn't make him unloving or ungracious, or we're going to see that later, because he can be both. Let's look at the last section here. And that's that God's wrath is evident. We can look around our creation today and see exactly what Paul is talking about, that God's wrath is being poured out. Do you remember what happened before the flood? The text tells us that the world had become so filled with violence that God's only solution was to wipe out everything except for 8 people. He literally scraped the planet clean. He didn't just kill human life. But it had gotten so bad that it affected creation so that God had to take the lives of all the animals and scrape the planet clean because sin had gone unchecked. Had God not stepped in, his creation would not have survived. And since that time, God has been at work. If you remember the story of Babel where he took and spread the people out, part of that was to protect his creation because when they were left together unchecked, massive sin. And so to try to prevent that, God spread them out. Because immediately after the flood, what they do? All come back together, reach the heavens, be like God, suppress that truth. Well, there's evidence of God working in his creation, but there's evidence of his wrath being poured out as well. Take a look at verses 24 and following. It says, therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way, also, men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire towards one another, men with men in decent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind, to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And finally, Paul takes a breath. And although they know the ordinances of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. So in these next 11 verses, what God or Paul actually points out is the punitive ways in which God's wrath has been poured out. He mentions two of them. Now, many people see three ways that God works here, because he uses this phrase, God hands them over three times. But when you look at the text, it breaks down really into two things. There are two ways here that God has executed his wrath, if you will. One of them is in their behavior. If you look at verses 24 and following, it says that God's wrath has been poured out, and then he gave them over to their immorality. Look at what it says. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity. And then the NASB says, so that their bodies would dishonor among men. I think it's a slight, the translation there's a little bit funny, but the phrase makes it clear, the lust of their hearts here is talking about sexual immorality. And that's what Paul focuses on here. Impurity is also a reference to sexual immorality. The fact that their bodies would be dishonored among them means that they've used their body in a shameful and disrespectful way. It wasn't the way it was designed. So what Paul basically says here is that the first way that we see God's judgment executed, or the punitive part of God's wrath poured out among people, is that he has handed them over to their behavior. He's basically said, I'm going to hand you over to your wicked behavior. Which means he hasn't completely protected them from consequences. Now, I don't like the phrase, so that, in this phrase here, in this verse, so that their bodies would be dishonored, because it gives the impression that God hands them over so that they would then go and do these things. In fact, the ESV actually translates it better. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among men. That so that phrase can be translated different ways, and it's not a resultative thing. It's not saying that God handed them over so that they would go do these things. It says that God handed them over in their doing of those things. He basically said, fine. Now, what's interesting about this is this phrase, gave them over. We would like to say and like to think that God simply said, okay, I'll let you do what you want to do. But the phrase gave them over is much stronger than that. In fact, the language actually involves a much more active part on God. It isn't that God simply took his hands off the wheel and said, okay, wherever it goes. Moo, who happens to be one of my favorite commentators on the book of Romans here, refers to it this way. God didn't just let go of the boat. He gave it a push. Like a judge who hands over a prisoner to the punishment his crime has earned, God hands over the sinner to the terrible cycle of ever-increasing sin. In other words, what God did was God didn't just say, oh, okay, I'm going to be hands-off and let you do whatever you want. God, in some respects, handed them over to their fate. Made an active decision to do just that. That they would face the consequence of their sin. Now, that's something that makes us very uncomfortable, isn't it? But that gives you an idea of the magnitude of the sin and the magnitude of God's wrath here and what the consequences are. It's not that God went, I just don't care anymore. God acted on that. And so in some respects, as Moo puts it, God sort of said, fine. I'm going to give an example here. I shared it with Dustin. We've talked. I think I might have even shared it here before. I'm going to share a story of one of my daughters, who shall remain nameless. Actually, Kimberly knows what I'm talking about here. Do you remember the time where, remember, what was the name of the game you played where you would jump on all the furniture? Do you remember what that was?
I never named it.
Well, there was a name for it. The Candyland game, for some reason. And we
just like to see if I could go all the way around the room without touching the ground.
So she would do this in the middle of the night. She would do this in the middle of the night. She would get on the furniture and jump across.
I would jump on my doll bed, jump on my nightstand. No, it was laundry basket, doll bed, nightstand, bed.
A
dresser?
Yes.
A dresser, CD player, toy box, and toy piano.
And let's stress for all the kids here, this is not a good idea.
Do not try this at home, the banner, right?
Don't model.
Now, my reason for doing this...
We're talking about how awesome this was.
Yes, yes, exactly. We're not saying this is really cool. Talk to Kimberly afterwards to get your instruction manual, right? But what was interesting is we had to deal with that because it's dangerous. She's jumping on furniture in the middle of the night, you know? And so we had told her not to do it, but she would still do it. And I don't know if you remember that, so this particular instance, I sat her down in her room, and I explained to her, this is not going to happen because you'll get spanked if you do it. And I could just see she was sort of like puffed up with pride. She didn't do it anyway. So I basically said, okay, go ahead and see what happens. And so she did. So I spanked her. I said, now we're going to stop? And she basically puffed up and said, no. I said, do it again. So she did it again. And I spanked her. Is it going to stop? No. I said, go ahead, do it again. And she did it again. And I spanked her. And Amy was there, and she knew I was getting to that point where I think one more time, and she might not have survived. But after that third time, all of a sudden it was like, click, click, click. Okay, this is how it's going to work. If I do this, I'm going to get spanked. Now, I knew that she was going to get disciplined. So I didn't just... Well, go ahead and do it again someday, and we'll find out what happens. And walk. No, I actually gave her a little bit of a push. I said, go ahead and do it. Go ahead and do it, honey, because I'm going to spank you. Now, right or wrong, whether you agree with that or disagree with that, in trying to deal with it, in some respects, I said, okay, go ahead. I'm going to encourage you to do it because I want you to see the consequence here, because you're not getting it when you just do it on your own. And in some respects, that's what we have a picture of God doing here, is he basically didn't just say, all right, fine, whatever, I'll let you get, you know, whatever happens, happens. God said, okay, I've warned you, and he's now handed them over, actively stepped in and said, fine, and handed them over to the consequence. And again, that makes us uncomfortable, but that's what the text says. So the first thing he does is he gave them over to their immoral behavior. It says that he gave them over to degrading passions, and he goes through this description of sexual immorality. We won't dwell on it too much, but for you kids, it simply means that men weren't marrying men, and the women weren't marrying, or the men were marrying men, and women were marrying women, and they were doing all those. Is that right? No, it's not right, is it? That's backwards thinking. And so, we see that even today to some degree, don't we? It just gets worse. It's nothing new. It's been this way. We, you know, it's funny, we think of gay marriage and stuff here in the United States. This is nothing, folks, compared to what they had in Rome. Pedophilia was legalized. You know, I mean, we're nowhere close to that yet. Now, is it bad here? Yes. Will we get there? Probably. But this is just one example that God gave them over to their behavior. We see that today when we look around, not just our nation, but the world. That God has given over mankind to those things. He hasn't done what he did at the flood. Maybe it hasn't gotten that bad yet compared to what it was like before the flood. But we see that in our own world today, that God has given over the world to their immorality. Second way that God's punitive acts can be seen here is what Paul says in verses 28 and 32, and that's that God's given them over to a depraved mind. So not only has God given the world over in some respects to their degraded behavior, but he's also given them over to a depraved mind. It says, and just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind. To do those things which are not proper. The word translated depraved there refers to failing a test or becoming disqualified. In other words, it's affected their thinking. It's that their minds have failed the test. They're no longer rational in what they think. They're worthless in their thinking. They're unable to reason properly. Do you think that's true today? Ever conversations with unsaved people sometimes? And think, what are they thinking? You know, and that doesn't mean they can't ever think right thoughts or smart things. And it doesn't mean that as Christians we always think right thoughts, right? But the reality of it is that God gave over mankind to a depraved mind. says that they do those things which are improper then as a result. I want you to look at verses 29 through 31 with me, because this describes what this looks like. Filled with unrighteousness, they're wicked, greedy, they're evil, they're full of envy. They murder, they're filled with strife and deceit, malice, they gossip, they slander, they hate God, they're insolent, they're arrogant, they're boastful, they invent evil, they're disobedient to their parents, they're without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving. That's what it looks like to have a depraved mind. Now all of this, we're said, or we're told, is done knowingly, willfully, and with hearty approval if you look at the very next verse. And although they know the ordinance of God, meaning they know these things, they know they're wrong. It's interesting, even pagan cultures have laws against a lot of what's written in this text. Because it's something that God's built into his creation. It's part of his invisible attributes. And it says that even though they know these things, and they know that it brings death, they not only do the same things, but they give hearty approval for those who practice them. You know, it's interesting. I love the fact that all this talk recently about draining the swamp out of Washington. Okay? Whether you agree with Trump or disagree with Trump, at least the mantra, drain the swamp, is, I mean, it is, folks. It is just a swamp there. And I love the fact that just recently here, was it the Senate that tried to pass laws to loosen some of the restrictions? I know, but they wanted to basically take, if they get caught doing something, they tried to protect all of those documents that are involved with what they were doing by allowing them to control them, basically meaning this. If a senator gets caught doing something illegal, what they tried to do is to change the law so that that senator could then legally not give any information that was requested to the FBI or the CIA to examine them. Because it's currently what the laws are. They can't protect that stuff. You know what? They steal money from their campaign, and the FBI or the CIA comes in and says, oh, you know what? Or the ethics committee comes in and says, we need to see all the paperwork on donations. By law, they have to give that up. So in the middle of this discussion about draining the swamp, and knowing that the American people want this stuff cleaned up, what they try to do is say, you know, we're going to change the laws here to protect ourselves so that we can't get caught doing the illegal things that we're doing. And they got their hand caught in the cookie jar. And so before they went ahead and did that, smack, they stopped. Left the rules in place. That's the way the brain thinks. It's this deprived mind. And that's what God has given over mankind to. That's the kind of things that we do. And they're all sitting around probably giddy about it. Look what we're going to do. When we get this done, it's going to protect us. And they're probably sitting around patting each other on the back until they got caught. So Paul says that not only do they do it themselves, but they applaud others that are doing it. So what do we basically have here in the text? Well, three things. God's wrath is real. God is not just a God of mercy and love and justice. He's a God of wrath. Not only is it justified because of our own sin and the things that mankind has chosen to do, but we already see it as being evident. We can look around and we can see it. Now, the good news is, in some respects, there's some restraint. So even though God has given over mankind to depraved mind and given him over to his behavior to some degree, he hasn't completely let go, has he? You know, Paul talks about the restrainer when he's writing the Thessalonians. But there's something restraining, if you will. We look at the story of Babel and we see that when mankind decided to go right back to their pre-flood behavior, God steps in and breaks them up and separates their languages to prevent some of that to some degree. So in many respects, God is still restraining. Hasn't allowed it to go to its full potential. And we can praise him for that. But the other thing I think that's important for us to see here is that remember how all this started out? Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the righteous man shall live by faith." So even though we just spent the whole morning talking about wrath, Paul started the discussion by saying that God has provided a solution for that wrath. So you take this very bad, very terrible situation that mankind has suppressed the truth of God, has rejected him, and as a result now faces wrath, his fury. There's already a solution. I love the fact that Paul didn't wait until he gets done with this whole discussion to talk about faith, because that's the solution to all of this. And so God provided a solution, even with Adam and Eve, if you think about that. Right when God is judging Adam and Eve, he tells them that there's a solution to their sin problem, that he'll provide a seed when he gets ready to judge the world. Before the flood, he takes Noah and his family and gives them 100 to 120 years to preach to the world around them. Didn't just execute it. Provided a solution. Somebody to preach. They still rejected it. That's the way God is. And so as we think about this today, it's a terrible situation that everybody, including us, at one time faced God's wrath. But God isn't just a God of wrath. He's a God of love and mercy and grace as well. Because he's provided a means to have that wrath satisfied. And that's through faith in Jesus Christ. The gospel, as Paul's already mentioned.